Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, December 15, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the future of labor law under the new administration. My name is Tim Courtney. I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Mr. David Fortney, who's co-founder at Fortney & Scott, LLC, Mr. Brent Guerin, Deputy General Counsel at the Service Employees International Union, and John Irving, who is of counsel at Kirkland & Ellis, LLP. And we'll be opening the floor to your questions after some initial remarks. And with that, I will turn the floor over to Mr. John Irving. John, go ahead.
Okay, Tim, thank you. And I would just embellish those introductions a little bit by saying that Brent Guerin is one of the foremost labor lawyers in the country, with whom management lawyers have very good and long-standing relationships and honor his views. David Fortney, as the founder of Fortney & Scott, is also a former solicitor of labor, and I've had various jobs at the NLRB myself before entering into private practice at Kirkland & Ellis in 1979, so we've all been around a long time. So why don't I lead off, and what we're going to do is kind of break this up into agency interest with particular departments and agencies, and I think what we'll do, I'll begin and talk about the National Labor Relations Board and the National Labor Relations Act, and then David Fortney will take over with the Department of Labor and EEOC, and then Brent will take time with his observations on what we say and other points of interest. So we'll each do about 10 minutes, and then we'll be opening it up for listener questions. So let me just start with the, you know, in right now, it's not just, well, there are a lot of interesting NLRB cases. I mean, we have this huge election change, and there'll be changes in personnel at these various agencies, all of which will have a kind of, I suspect, a major impact on agency policies and decisions and so on. Just looking at the NLRB first, of course, the NLRB has five members normally. Right now, it has three members, two Democrat members and one Republican member. The chairman is Mark Pierce, whose term expires in August of 2018. Member Lauren McFerrin, another Democrat appointee, December 2019. The Republican member of the board is Phil Mescamera, and his term expires in 2017. And of course, we have, you know, some really two major parts to this agency. One is the board, and the other is general counsel. And the general counsel now is Richard Griffin, has a four-year appointment to the board. His term expires in November of 2017. So obviously there will be changes in composition most immediately with the board, because there are, in fact, two vacancies at the board. And things that might change immediately, nobody knows for sure, but there's precedent for it, that when there is a change of party like this, the chairmanship can be shifted. That is, there's no such thing as acting board members, but the chairmanship among sitting board members can be moved, and it's probably foreseeable that the chairmanship pretty quickly will be moved from the current chairman, Mark Pierce, to Phil Mescamera. as I say, the general counsel stays in place. So it's likely then, because the membership on the board and the general attitudes of the board, majority and minority, will likely be altered and changing, that we'll see some significant changes on the important issues, importance to all sides. Let's talk about issues. The issues that are the most controversial under the current board and for the last years, and keep in mind too, when we talk about changes in policy at the board, you know, it'll take time at the board. It's not like a new chairman or a new board can come in and just order a bunch of new things or change policies and so on. You know, there's a decisional kind of mechanism in the statute where cases have come up and will be coming up, and policies will be changed in accordance with those changes, which take time because changes will have to make their way to the board, generally through the administrative process and through administrative law judges, who will likely follow the current board view of these different issues. And then if there's going to be a change, it would be after the board or during the board's review of administrative law judges. So it's not going to be like in the first 2 months of a new administration there are going to be major changes. So then, all right, well, what are the areas that are most likely to be the focus of change or refocus by a new majority on the board? And I think they're kind of obvious to all of us. I guess one of the main one that I would point to has to do with the board's current approach to joint employers and who's a joint employer and who isn't, and the tendency under the major case, which is Browning Ferris, 362 NLRB number 186, is to, for the under the current board, is to kind of go up the organization as much as possible and emphasize the kind of control that the owner or a franchisor principle would have on the organizations that are under the umbrella, and will be looking under the current board rule. Board gives a lot of emphasis not just to sort of direct control over employee working conditions of, for instance, franchisees, but also the indirect and potential control, which sort of gets to ownership. And all of that is spelled out in the case that everybody waited for a long time, which is Browning Ferris, which I mentioned, and which is currently under appeal and before the D.C. Circuit. And people are waiting to see what the D.C. Circuit's going to do with that. So that's a major issue for management and for labor. It has a real impact as a practical matter on such things as secondary boycotts, because the less sort of independence there is, the more susceptible the sort of owner franchisor can become subject to union picketing, which might ordinarily be called secondary boycott, unlawful picketing, but which in this framework would not necessarily. And a related issue that everyone is very interested in is the new board's approach to who's an independent contractor and who isn't. And that has major secondary boycott implications as well, where the board has diverted from what has been kind of the traditional test of independent contractor, and its new test has come very close to one that is being applied in, for instance, Fair Labor Standards area by the Department of Labor, which is one that is called the economic realities test, which a lot of us view as the board or the Department of Labor doing pretty much whatever it wants to do with respect to independent contractors. I'm sure Brent will have another view of that. But the key case there is FedEx Home Delivery, C61 NLRB number 55, which and an advice memo by the General Counsel, which is in Pacific 9 Transportation at December 18, 2015. Other ones I'll just touch on. A lot of you on this call probably will know exactly what I'm talking about. That has to do with like micro bargaining units, where under the key case, which is specialty healthcare, 357 NLRB 3934, the board has looks favorably on portions of what would otherwise be presumptively appropriate production and maintenance units, where unions may petition for portions of those normally appropriate units. And what that boils down to is frequently that the unions will, the unions are forbidden to premise their, under the statute, their request for smaller units based upon extent of organization. But what this gets down to is pretty much what the union prefers. And then in order to overcome what the board would do, would allow a complainer employer that wants a larger unit would have to show that the unit that the union wants is like has an overwhelming community of interest with the rest of the employee group. Another one area will be having to do with mandatory arbitration, where the NLRB has taken a dim view of employment agreements that require employees to arbitrate their problems rather than litigate with their concurrence. But if it's a condition of employment, the NLRB says that that interferes with their rights under the National Labor Relations Act. Employers say that that has to do with favoring arbitration under federal arbitration statutes. The key case there is a case called Horton, D.R. Horton, and the courts have gone both ways. Some courts agree with the board, some courts agree with the employer, and those issues are before the Supreme Court right now in a case called Murphy Oil, where the NLRB has petitioned for cert, which is a good idea to resolve this issue once and for all. Deferral to arbitration. There's a new rule that the general counsel, this is kind of in the general counsel's bailiwick, where the general counsel usually has been pretty quick to defer to arbitration where a dispute is subject likely to be resolved in arbitration, within kind of a minor review of that, and that after the arbitration. Now the general counsel, before deciding whether to defer to arbitration, will investigate the case, defer then to arbitration, and general counsel doesn't like the result, thinks it's inconsistent with the statute, then the general counsel will issue a complaint and litigate the case. So really you get two bites at the arbitration apple. Use of email systems for organizational activities, that's Purple Communications. And then there have been some undermining of what management regards as really important rules with respect to acquisition, asset sales, and circumstances under which the acquirer has an opportunity to set its own terms. When the bargaining unit is made up of the employees of the seller, or a majority of them, then the purchaser of assets would have to neg- negotiate a new labor agreement if that's what it wishes to do. And in the meantime, the old terms are in effect, and that is a whole area that for which there's great interest. And then finally, the board's new rules on elections, which management characterizes as ambush elections. That's a long rule that the board issued, has many, many parts, and that at some point will, I'm sure, be dissected and changed in many respects by the new majority on the board, but that too is likely to take some time. So in the meantime, there may be some legislative shortcuts to some of these issues, but you know, that all remains to be seen too. I think I've pretty much taken up my time, and we'll be happy to answer questions that anybody might have in a little while after the others present, and I'll turn it over now to David Fortney.
Sure, John, thank you, and greetings everyone. What I would like to do is fill in a little bit about the issues and changes we see coming in the U.S. Department of Labor and the EEOC, two agencies that also have implemented a number of significant regulations, policies, and other changes during the Obama administration that have been quite significant and that are likely to change. I listened to the list of changes that John just cataloged for us by the NLRB, and you really realize how much has occurred, and that is certainly true similarly in the Labor Department and EEOC. Well, let's start with some of the key staffing questions, because those boxes, if you will, are beginning to get filled in. President-elect has announced that he will nominate Andrew Puzder to become serve as his Secretary of Labor. Puzder is currently the CEO of CKE Restaurants. CKE Restaurants is a parent holding company, and its principal restaurants that it operates and owns include Hardee's and Carl's Jr., both of which are well-known fast food restaurants, and CKE Restaurants employ approximately 75,000 employees. Mr. Puzder comes with a pretty strong track record of involvement and opinions with respect to a number of workplace issues, particularly those involving joint employment, particularly those involving minimum wage, as well as some immigration issues. And let me just touch on each of those because they may be instructive as he assumes his new duties, assuming that he's confirmed, which I think is highly likely. Excuse me. With respect to minimum wage, Mr. Puzder has, and I should have by way of background, Puzder also is a lawyer and practiced law and now has experience also as a senior executive within these restaurant holding companies. Puzder has made his views known with respect to a number of these issues. He has a very active blog. He is a person who authors a number of opinions in Forbes magazine, the Wall Street Journal, has testified before Congress multiple times on workforce issues, so he's not a stranger to these issues. With respect to minimum wage, the proposed increase of minimum wage nationwide, the federal minimum wage to $15, Mr. Puzder has previously commented that he opposes that, has stated his concerns that that is too much of an increase for a national standard, recognizing that in many marketplaces that would impose a real hardship and have significant adverse consequences. However, Mr. Puzder also has recognized that there are room under our system for different and higher local wages, either by state or localities, which of course is what we have today. His comments have indicated that he would favor a slower phase-in of increasing minimum wage, and has several times commented or identified that perhaps up to $9 would be an appropriate federal minimum wage. Again, these are views pretty common, held by many economists that have looked at these issues. With respect to the expansive joint employer doctrine, and John Irving in his comments identified that, and that same view has been adopted and followed by the Labor Department agencies. Mr. Puzzer has recognized that the resulting consequences with respect particularly to franchise employers, and as many may know, the NLRB has major enforcement action pending against McDonald's under the joint employer doctrine, and Mr. Puzzer has pointed out that the expansive reading of joint employer that currently has been advocated by the administration has had very severe consequences, particularly on the franchise as well as other sectors. So he would align with changing certainly those tests too. Finally, a view that I think may surprise some with Mr. Puzzer's previously stated views on immigration. Mr. Puzzer has spoken repeatedly about the importance of lawful immigration and spoken in strong support of the H-2B programs. These are programs where immigrants come in for short periods of time and typically hold jobs in hospitality, restaurants, landscaping. These are typically lower-skilled jobs where people work for a season or shorter period of time and then leave. Some were surprised because many have understood the incoming administration as being so-called anti-immigration. Apparently, that is not Mr. Puzzer's view. He has spoken previously but strongly in favor of lawful immigration, and specifically the H-2B program. Other key points that I think will be very important as the Labor Department gets filled out, we're beginning to hear strong indicators as to who may hold key positions, and it appears that the common thread is that these are many people who have had prior experience and a deep understanding of the Labor Department, which would be very helpful in enabling Mr. Puzzer's Labor Department, the Trump administration, to hit the blocks and move out fairly quickly in implementing changes. With respect to his deputy secretary, Pat Pizzilla, who formerly was in the Labor Department, held a senior position during the Bush administration, very well regarded, currently a member of the Federal Labor Relations Authority. The Solicitor of Labor, who is the third ranking official in the Labor Department, again, strong published reports indicating that Tammy McCutcheon, currently a partner at Littler, former Labor Department official. She formerly was the wage and hour administrator that promulgated the white-collar exemption regulations that have been the subject of a recent amendment that I'll talk about in a moment. Again, Tammy would bring an excellent understanding of the DOL agencies, operations, rulemaking, et cetera. With respect to some of the key agencies, wage and hour has proven to be perhaps one of the most critical agencies. And a gentleman by the name of Alex Passantino, who formerly served as the acting wage hour administrator, is often highlighted at this point and shortlisted as a potential nominee. All of these people would require, of course, confirmation to those positions. But if it would shape up either with those folks or ones of similar qualifications, it would present a nice combination of Mr. Puzzer with his business background and understanding of these issues as a businessman and a lawyer, combined with very seasoned hands who understand the Labor Department in great detail. With respect to key issues we can anticipate the Labor Department to address pretty quickly, the overtime regulations, which recall there was a regulation that the Obama administration finalized that would have resulted in an increase in the salary test for the white-collar exemption regulations, essentially doubling that to $47,000. That would have been effective December 1. That was enjoined approximately 2 weeks ago by the judge in the Eastern District of Texas. Although there are expedited appeals pending, it is quite clear that the incoming administration, if that regulation still remains viable, I think we'll in due course see that it is ended. I might add a footnote, though. Assuming that that regulation as proposed by the prior administration on overtime is terminated, it is likely that there would be a new overtime regulation by the new administration, because the salary test most have agreed, which is just under $24,000, is on the low side. And if you simply would do a cost of living adjustment from when the current salary was set in 2004, we would bring it up to about $32,000 to $34,000 in that range. And I think that type of change, as well as addressing, helping to codify fluctuating work week and some other changes, may be in order. There was another controversial Labor Department regulation, so-called persuader rule, that had a very expansive reporting on advisors who advise companies in the responding to union organizing matters specifically. And the tension point there was that attorneys who provided legal advice would have been required to disclose their clients as well as the advice that was being provided, fees collected, and other information. This brought a judicial challenge from a number of states who felt that the administration improperly encroached on their ability to regulate the practice of law. The American Bar Association also opposed the rule as encroaching on the attorney privileges and related doctrine. And again, a district court in Texas has enjoined the persuader rule that was this summer. And I think it's fairly safe to say that those items will be remain on hold. There were a number of executive orders that the President Obama issued affecting federal contractors. This really represented, once the congressional avenue became blocked, the president then turned and issued executive orders that imposed additional obligations on federal contractors. Many of these were controversial and are likely to receive prompt attention. These changes, in contrast to some of the changes John was talking about for the Labor Board, an executive order, which can be issued by the president unilaterally, doesn't require congressional approval or rulemaking. Similarly, prior executive orders can be rescinded in an expedited fashion without any further involvement. Potential executive orders that are certainly under consideration, and many view as being under the chopping block, first and foremost, would be what was known as the Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces Executive Order, sometimes referred to as the blacklisting. Again, this is another major rulemaking that the courts have enjoined a portion of. Today, already, there was self-reporting on violations. There were restrictions on private arbitration agreements, except for collective bargaining, and what were called paycheck transparency obligations involving statements that needed to be included in paychecks. The first two components, self-reporting on violations and the restrictions on arbitration, those have currently been enjoined in a nationwide injunction with an expedited appeal pending. The paycheck transparency obligations are scheduled to go into place starting January 1. It is likely, I think, that the blacklisting executive order will be rescinded, which would result in all of the underlying regulations also being removed. With respect to other significant executive orders, and there were quite a few of them, there is a paid sick leave executive order that may or may not receive attention from the Obama administration. And also there was an order providing for LGBT protections that was signed. The LGBT executive order has been criticized because it does not contain a significant religious accommodation or carve-out provision. And if you look at the state of Indiana, where Governor Pence, now Vice President-elect Pence, had a similar executive order, it had a quite significant carve-out for religious considerations on an LGBT-type order. That type of change is certainly possible as an amendment to the LGBT executive order. There, the In terms of regulations, we know that all the regulations are being looked at by the agencies. They've been asked to rank their regulations from most recent to oldest and what they believe are most important. President-elect has indicated that there will be a requirement that for every new regulation issued, two regulations have to be eliminated. That is a system that has been employed successfully in England. In fact, they've moved to a 3-to-1 ratio now. We may see that happening here. Also, that there will be additional review of new regulations with a specific consideration, assessment, and evaluation on how the new regulation promotes employment opportunities. That will become one of the chief requirements. Let me turn from the Labor Department, because although it is the cabinet-level advisor and has all of the various enforcement agencies, the Labor Board is independent, as John has explained, and then we also have the EEOC, which is also an independent agency. Again, like the Labor Board, the EEOC is a 5-member agency currently comprised of 2 Republicans and 3 Democrats. One of the 2 Republicans, her term has just ended. That's Constance Barker. And Congress managed to leave town without appointing her, so the president will start with a vacancy there. The president does have the right to name a new chair. It is highly likely that the remaining Republican member of the EEOC, Victoria Lipnick, will be named at least as acting chair or possibly as a permanent chair. Vicki Lipnick is, again, a very well-known, very well-regarded person. In addition to her service at the EEOC, previously served at the Labor Department, senior positions, where she and other agencies had the OFCCP and other agencies under her direction, and also very well-regarded on the Hill. So it's likely that we would end up with Victoria Lipnick as the chair of the EEOC. The president also will appoint, subject to confirmation, a new general counsel and other key positions. So again, as with the Labor Board, filling some of these positions may take a little bit of time, may not be quite as quick as we had with the Labor Department, but we'll fill in. With respect to key initiatives that we can anticipate from the EEOC, first, out of the blocks, there is a recently enacted requirement that requires all employers with 100 or more employees to report their compensation data. Very onerous, burdensome requirement. It would first go into effect in March of 2018. There is a strong move afoot that the compensation reporting, as part of EEO-1 reporting, could be modified or rescinded. I think that's likely to receive favorable attention. Certainly, Victoria Lipnick has been a strong critic of that and has advocated that there are a number of different procedures that could be followed to more effectively collect and understand employer data. There is EEOC rulemaking on the final rule on the wellness, the ability to conduct wellness exams. The EEOC, I think, surprised many people, including those in the current White House, when it opined that the ability to conduct a wellness exam, say to qualify for insurance, et cetera, violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. And many people found that strange and, frankly, unacceptable. So there is a move afoot to ensure that that loose end is tied up. Finally, the EEOC has promulgated a very robust strategic plan. These are very important for guiding the agency. It is highly likely that the strategic plan just codified under the Obama administration would receive review and revisions by the Trump administration's EEOC within the first 12 months after it starts rolling. So, we do see some rulemaking in EEOC, but some other changes, certainly some changes in direction, and changing. I think it's highly likely that the EEOC track record that has resulted in often what courts found to be inappropriate use of the legal enforcement authority current EEOC general counsel was sanctioned repeatedly, literally millions of dollars in sanctions, and has kind of an eye-popping record in that regard. I think that those more adventurous attempts to expand the law in ways that, that are outside the current statutes as they exist will probably be trimmed back, likely, under an EEOC headed by Commissioner Lipnick.
Oh. Thanks, David. You've covered a lot of ground here. It was very, very useful. Let's turn it over to Brent, and let's hear his view.
I think he only needs 5 minutes of rebuttal,
yeah.
Don't you, John?
Yeah. there is a lot, obviously, and I don't think that what was envisioned or would be particularly useful for me to say, oh, but I really agree with the joint employer position and here's why. If that's what people want to hear on questions, I'm very happy to do it. To me, what I want to say in any event is I hope that, I mean, now we have Republican control of what will become with the appointments, all three branches. And I'm sure that folks are eager to impose their program. But I would urge folks in the administration, advising the administration, supporting the administration, whatever, to give a lot of thought to the long-term consequences for our country of what you're doing, what you're going to do. We have massive growth of inequality, in wage inequality, income inequality. We have huge swaths of the country that are economically reeling, in horrible shape. And we have to figure out what we can do to address that. And I think we are in the process of creating a much more stratified class society than we've ever had in this country before, in terms of social mobility, in terms of the wealthy having their own communities, schools, hospitals, everything in their world being really completely separate and isolated from the rest of the population. And I just think that a lot of the changes that are being proposed are going to worsen these problems. I really hope people think in terms of, I don't know if this analogy will be meaningful to people, but, you can have a company, you can do things to boost the bottom line for a quarter or a year that end up being very injurious to the long-term health of the company. And I think that that's what I'm afraid that that's what we're going to see. Things that are attractive in terms of denying people overtime or, whatever it is, not increasing the minimum wage sufficiently, whatever the issue. And that the result is the deepening of the stratification of this country, which I think very legitimately threatens our democracy and threatens our way of life in a way that, we haven't seen a threat, certainly, say, since the Depression or World War II, certainly in my lifetime. So I'm happy to engage on any particular issue, but I really do think that when we look at what's going on, we have control of the government by one party. It's a party that received the minority of votes by several million. And to take that as a mandate to, I just think is going to going to cause a lot of problems. So I don't know if that's helpful to anybody or if people want me to engage on particular topics, but that's my general reaction. Obviously, these changes are going to occur. I think I don't disagree with anything John or David said. I think all those, or the great majority of those changes, will be implemented. And the question is, where is it going to take us as a country? So I'll stop there.
Okay, well, that's very helpful, and was a good idea without having to go through each one of those issues. The point is that there are, you know, different sides to all of the things that were mentioned, and, you know, to have that discussion will be good and be interesting, and it'll be good to have people like Brent and others and David on in the discussion of all of them. Is there anything else that, David, did you have any further comment that you'd like to make?
No, John, I'd like to give the audience a shot. I'm sure they've got some questions. I think that, though, Brent's observation that, you know, short-term gain, sound public policy, he is correct. It's not about short-term. It's not based on a quarterly return. And that's why one of the reasons I am heartened by the thought that some of the key players, I think, in some of these agencies are going to be very experienced and who do understand public policy and long-term consequences that should be effected from that. Now, reasonable minds can differ on what those policies should be, but I think that's a very important point that I fully agree with.
All right. Shall we turn this over, Tim? Tim Courtney, should we turn this over to see whether our audience or participants have any questions they'd like us to focus on?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got about almost 20 minutes left for questions. In a moment, we're all going to hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. And then after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. Again, if you'd like to jump in the queue for questions, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. While we wait for a couple questions to queue up, let me just remind everyone to check back the FedSoc website at fedsoc.org to look at the next scheduled telephone calls. And with that, we will go to our first audience question.
Yes, John, this is Bill Emanuel. Thanks for an excellent panel discussion by all the panelists. My question relates to the ambush election rule. How do you see the board, the new board handling that the changes in that regulation? What do you think the new board should do?
Well, this is Irving. I don't mind jumping in. And Bill, how are you? We know each other well, and
yes.
Thank you for your question. And you know, when you think about rulemaking, you know, there are different difficulties there with respect to changes in rules and how much of it has to be done by notice and comment and more formal rulemaking, or how much of it can be done by interpretation of rules. My guess is that a new board would be kind of looking through that rule to see, first of all, what they might disagree with, and then the best way, most efficient way, to try to get it, to try to change it. I know there are elements of it that are a real problem for a lot of people. In that new rule, there's one that I keep focusing on that has to do, I've never seen the board actually overrule a case in a rule. And it did that in a case that was mostly my case called Barry National, where the board decided, contrary to the hearing officer, that I would have an opportunity at the representation case hearing to litigate the status of line leaders. And the company had all kinds of proof that and arguments that their line leaders were supervisors, and they needed to know before the election whether they're sort of eligible to be in the unit or eligible to be in management. Because if they're in management, you know, they can say certain things, and if they're in the unit, they could, if they're instructed to do certain things, it would, you know, be a potential unfair labor practice, and you need to know who's on your side and who isn't, and who can talk, and so on. And the board agreed with me in Barry National that I would be entitled, I was, you know, not enabled to or permitted to litigate that pre-election. The board agreed with me that I was. Now, they overruled that case in the rule, and I think they've got big problems going forward if somebody chooses to litigate that issue about their entitlement. Anyway, I think there'll be a lot of picking and choosing among, and the most important board rule would be that election rule, which goes on for, you know, dozens of pages.
This is Brent. If I may jump in, I think the election rule is really an important thing to look at for the following reason. All the evidence since the rule has gone into effect has been that the rule has cut down the time involved in processing the cases, has reduced the amount of expenditure of resources by the parties and the board in conducting elections, and the results have not been particularly pro-union. They have not, the number of elections has not increased dramatically. The number of elections, the win rate, the size of the units, none of it has really changed. The only thing that's really changed is there is they cut the average period of time by 10 or 12 days, the median, I guess. And so I think the evidence is that the rule has been quite successful. And I hope that this is sort of an example of what I was talking about. When the new board looks at the rule, they won't have a knee-jerk ideological reaction, but will in fact look at the results, which have been, you know, very, very good. And not, you know, not skewed in a pro-union way.
I think what you say is so. I know what you say is so in terms of the timing. But, you know, the timing has been collapsed substantially with the result that employers can't really get it up front early decisions on issues that it regards as important. And I'll go back to that specialty healthcare micro unit case that I was talking about. If the union wants to parse out a portion of what would ordinarily be the unit and file an election petition for that, then things do really get speeded up because it can get to its election very quickly, and if the employer disagrees and wants to have the board review what the regional director would do before the election, the board under that specialty healthcare would be, you know, turn away probably 98% of the of those pre-election challenges, which then results in a quicker election for sure, but also means that if the employer is serious about it after the election, that's not really part of the timing equation, we'll have to litigate it and refuse to bargain and get a board decision and take it to court and so on. So when you look at sort of the back half of the election, of the rule result, it may not be as effectively time limiting as if you look at the pre-election.
Again, oh, I'm sorry. Are you done, John?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, so just there's Brent again. Again, I think specialty health care, take a look at the actual results. The size of the units in board elections has not changed. The median number of employees in the unit has not changed following specialty health care. There's no evidence that specialty health care has produced a change in the size of the unit. Not only that, every court of appeals that has looked at it, and there are four or five of them, I believe, has endorsed specialty health care and said it's not a change in policy. Specialty health care has always been the law. When John says, well, you're carving out a portion of what's normally the unit, that's not accurate. The unit is any, under the labor board, any appropriate unit that the union petitions for. If it's an appropriate unit, that's the unit in which you go to election. It is only if you can show, and this has always been true, that the petition for unit is inappropriate, that you can expand it. Now, I'm sure the new board will find it, you know, different, will look at it differently and find only a bigger unit is appropriate much more often than the current board. But again, there's, to me, a sort of ideological reaction that if you look at the facts and the evidence, there's just not that much to complain about or anything to complain about.
I think I'm kind of guided by, maybe overly guided by, my own experience with that, and that was a case where the union petitioned for production employees and specifically wanted excluded the maintenance employees who worked with production employees. And normally, in a presumptively appropriate unit, we have production and maintenance, and they just wanted the production employees, and it was a practical matter. They were, I think, concerned that the mechanical maintenance employees were not as pro-union. So they get an election in just that portion of the production unit without the people that, and it's difficult to make the, you know, the argument that there's such an over, and there was a clear interaction, but was that like overwhelming a situation where, you know, it's so crystal clear that the maintenance people should be there. Then you have to litigate that and you go on and on. But yeah, I mean, the size of the maintenance unit stayed, but it didn't include, or size of the production unit stayed as before, but it didn't include a substantial number of maintenance people.
I think I'm going to break in here really quick. I just want to make sure we have time to get to our next question. Again, just a reminder to request the floor, enter star and the pound key on your telephone, and with that, we're going to go to our next question.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is a bit more on the arbitration side of things from the first lecture. Last year, DirecTV's case in the Supreme Court, you know, was ruled in their favor that they could require their customers to participate in mandatory arbitration. Is it possible, do you think, that the Supreme Court could use that case as justification for companies to make the same mandate for their employees? Or do you think the National Labor Relations Act provides some kind of textual roadblock for that?
You're asking everybody or anybody in particular?
Oh, just anybody in particular.
let Irving start on that.
Okay.
I would just say that that it is that issue or that type of issue that is presently before the Supreme Court right now in that case that the ARP used to petition for cert to resolve the differences among the between the among the courts. It's called Murphy Oil. And the Supreme Court's being asked to resolve this difference. I mean, the NLRB, the NLRA says that private dispute resolution should be preferred, and there's a strong national policy in favor of arbitration. And you know, yet the NLRB, you know, takes the position that somehow the Section 7 concerns of employees takes precedent, and, you know, about half the courts have said the NLRB is right, and half the courts have said it's wrong. So it's something that the Supreme Court is going to have to resolve.
Well,
now, do you have any predictions how they'll resolve it?
I think it probably depends upon the balance in the Supreme Court, to be honest with you.
If I may just jump in, just to be clear about what the issue is, the Labor Board is not preventing arbitration or even mandatory arbitration. The only thing the Labor Board has said is illegal is where you have mandatory arbitration and you have banned class or collective or, you know, two or more employees joining together around the same issue. And that's, in their opinion, which I naturally I agree with, based squarely on the text of Section 7 of the NLRA, which gives workers the right to come together to try to better their wages and conditions of work, including, and it, the law is very clear, that Section 7 includes grievances or, you know, issues that would go to arbitration, such as enforcing the FLSA. So that is the heart of the argument. What the court will do with it, we'll see. But it is, that's why it's not settled by the commercial consumer arbitration issues. And let me just say, to me, this issue really, look, if employers can require individual arbitration of fair, you know, minimum wage and overtime claims, as well as others, the reality is, and I hope people understand this, it has been essentially the repeal of the FLSA, because nobody will be able to enforce the FLSA in any meaningful way if you have to do individual arbitrations. And I don't care if the minimum wage is $9 or $35, it's going to be irrelevant, because it will never be meaningfully enforced. And people who are hot on this issue on the management side, I hope you seriously consider whether that's good for our society, that the courts have repealed the FLSA in reality. I mean, that would be the effect. And I just, if I may have one more moment, we have, under Obama, since the, you know, Great Recession, there have been something, whatever it is, 8 million jobs added. I don't know the number. Lots of jobs added, unemployment down. And the problem is, or a huge problem is, that the jobs are low-wage, part-time, contingent, that don't provide a meaningful path into the middle class. And things like judicial repeal of the FLSA may give us more jobs, but they will give us, if they do, which, you know, is questionable in my mind, but assuming for a moment they do, they will further the class stratification of this country, cement the permanent underclass, and be a huge threat to our democracy. But other than that, I'm neutral on the subject.
Well, I would just, and maybe it's kind of a concluding remark, as we go through these changes in personnel, particularly the board, because one of them most, and the for the last 6 or 8 years, the role that the minority on the board has played with very good, very significant legal arguments in dissent, so far guiding the courts. I hope that when the balance changes on the board, that there will be dissenters, Democrat board members of the same kind of quality as the current dissenters, and people like Brent Garren, for instance, who are persuasive and know the law, and you know, that attitude and that point of view, as in the past 8 years, needs to be expressed and expressed well by dissenters on the board.
Agreed.
Since we're right up against our time limit here, if we could get some quick final thoughts from Brent or David, if you have any.
I kind of gave my final thought.
Okay. This is David. I think some people, I'm a little concerned, have had the view that there will either be no regulations, no enforcement, that this will be sort of a wide open environment we're moving into. And everything that I'm seeing and hearing is that is not going to be the case. There are going to be some philosophical differences in approach. Yes, but the enforcement agencies are going to continue to enforce. Compliance is going to continue to be a critical part. And I think that there will be even expansion into areas, including paid leave, compensation enforcement, and a variety of issues where the horizons will continue to change for all of us. So it will be different, but it's not ending.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd again like to thank David Fortney, Brent Guerin, and John Irving for joining us today. And to all of our listeners and those who ask questions, please keep checking back the our website at fedsoc.org for teleforms in the future. Thanks so much for joining us, and with that, we are adjourned. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleform Conference Call on the Future of Labor Law Under the New Administration. My name is Tim Courtney. I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Mr. David Fortney, who's co-founder at Fortney & Scott, LLC, Mr. Brent Guerin, Deputy General Counsel at the Service Employees International Union, and John Irving, who is of counsel at Kirkland & Ellis, LLP. And we'll be opening the floor to your questions after some initial remarks. And with that, I will turn the floor over to Mr. John Irving. John, go ahead.
Okay, Tim, thank you. And I would just embellish those introductions a little bit by saying that Brent Guerin is one of the foremost labor lawyers in the country, with whom management lawyers have very good and long-standing relationships and honor his views. David Fortney, as the founder of Fortney & Scott, is also a former solicitor of labor, and I've had various jobs at the NLRB myself before entering into private practice at Kirkland & Ellis in 1979, so we've all been around a long time. So why don't I lead off, and what we're going to do is kind of break this up into agency interest with particular departments and agencies. And I think what we'll do, I'll begin and talk about the National Labor Relations Board and the National Labor Relations Act. And then David Fortney will take over with the Department of Labor and EEOC. And then Brent will take time with his observations on what we say and other points of interest. So we'll each do about 10 minutes, and then we'll be opening it up for listener questions. So let me just start with the, you know, in right now, it's not just, well, there are a lot of interesting NLRB cases. I mean, we have this huge election change, and there'll be changes in personnel at these various agencies, all of which will have a kind of, I suspect, a major impact on agency policies and decisions and so on. Just looking at the NLRB first, of course, the NLRB has five members normally. Right now, it has three members, two Democrat members, and one Republican member. The chairman is Mark Pierce, whose term expires in August of 2018. Member Lauren McFerrin, another Democrat appointee, December 2019. The Republican member of the board is Phil Mescamara, and his term expires in 2017. And of course, we have some really two major parts to this agency. One is the board, and the other is general counsel. And the general counsel now is Richard Griffin. Has a four-year appointment to the board. His term expires in November of 2017. So obviously there will be changes in composition most immediately with the board, because there are in fact two vacancies at the board, and things that might change immediately, nobody knows for sure, but there's precedent for it that when there is a change of party like this, the chairmanship can be shifted. That is, there's no such thing as acting board members, but the chairmanship among sitting board members can be moved, and it's probably foreseeable that the chairmanship pretty quickly will be moved from the current chairman, Mark Pierce, to Phil Miscamara. And as I say, the general counsel stays in place, so it's likely then, because the membership on the board and the general attitudes of the board majority and minority will likely be altered and changing, that that we'll see some significant changes on the important issues, wardens to all sides. Let's talk about issues. The issues that are the most controversial under the current board and for the last years, and keep in mind too, when we talk about changes in policy at the board, it'll take time at the board. It's not like a new chairman or a new board can come in and just order a bunch of new things or change policies and so on. There's a decisional kind of mechanism in the statute where cases have come up and will be coming up, and policies will be changed in accordance with those changes, which take time because changes that will have to make their way to the board, generally through the administrative process and through administrative law judges, who will likely follow the current board view of these different issues. And then if there's going to be a change, it would be after the board or during the board's review of administrative law judges. So it's not going to be like in the first 2 months of a new administration there are going to be major changes. So then, all right, well, what are the areas that are most likely to be the focus of change or refocus by a new majority on the board? And I think they're kind of obvious to all of us. I guess one of the main one that I would point to has to do with the board's current approach to joint employers and who's a joint employer and who isn't, and the tendency under the major case, which is Browning Ferris at 362 NLRB number 186, is to, for the under the current board, is to kind of go up the organization as much as possible and emphasize the kind of control that the owner or a franchisor principal would have on the organizations that are under the umbrella, and will be looking under the current board rule. Board gives a lot of emphasis not just to sort of direct control over employee working conditions of, for instance, franchisees, but also the indirect and potential control, which sort of gets to ownership. And all of that is spelled out in the case that everybody waited for a long time, which is Browning Ferris, which I mentioned, and which is currently under appeal and before the D.C. Circuit, and people are waiting for the see what the D.C. Circuit's going to do with that. So that is a that's a major issue for for management and for labor. It has a real impact as a practical matter on such things as secondary boycotts, because the less independence there is, the more susceptible the sort of owner franchisor can become subject to union picketing, which might ordinarily be called secondary boycott, unlawful picketing, but which in this framework would not necessarily. And a related issue that everyone is very interested in is the new board's approach to who's an independent contractor and who isn't, and that has major secondary boycott implications as well, where the board has diverted from what has been kind of the traditional test of independent contractor, and its new test has come very close to one that is being applied in, for instance, the Fair Labor Standards area by the Department of Labor, which is one that is called the Economic Realities Test, which a lot of us view as the board or the Department of Labor doing pretty much whatever it wants to do with respect to independent contractors. I'm sure Brent will have another view of that, but the key case there is FedEx Home Delivery, 361 NLRB, number 55, and an advice memo by the General Counsel, which is in Pacific 9 Transportation, December 18, 2015. Other ones I'll just touch on. A lot of you on this call probably will know exactly what I'm talking about. That has to do with micro bargaining units, where under the key case, which is specialty healthcare, 357 NLRB 3934, the board has looks favorably on portions of what would otherwise be presumptively appropriate production and maintenance units, where unions may petition for portions of those normally appropriate units, and what that boils down to is frequently that the unions will, the unions are forbidden to premise their under the statute, their request for smaller units based upon extent of organization. But what this gets down to is pretty much what the union prefers. And then in order to overcome what the board would do, would allow a complainer employer that wants a larger unit would have to show that the unit that the union wants is has an overwhelming community of interest with the rest of the employee group. Another one area will be having to do with mandatory arbitration, where the NLRB has taken a dim view of employment agreements that require employees to arbitrate their problems rather than litigate with their concurrence. But if it's a condition of employment, the NLRB says that interferes with their rights under the National Labor Relations Act. Employers say that has to do with favoring arbitration under federal arbitration statutes. The key case there is a case called Horton, D.R. Horton, and the courts have gone both ways. Some courts agree with the board, some courts agree with the employer, and those issues are before the Supreme Court right now in a case called Murphy Oil, where the NLRB has petitioned for cert, which is a good idea to resolve this issue once and for all. Deferral to arbitration. There's a new rule that the general counsel, this is kind of in the general counsel's bailiwick, where the general counsel usually has been pretty quick to defer to arbitration where a dispute is subject or likely to be resolved in arbitration within, kind of a minor review of that, and that after the arbitration, now the general counsel, before deciding whether to defer to arbitration, will investigate the case, defer then to arbitration, and general counsel doesn't like the result, thinks it's inconsistent with the statute, then the general counsel will issue a complaint to litigate the case. So really, you get two apples, two bites at the arbitration apple. Use of emails, email systems for organizational activities, that's Purple Communications. And then there have been some undermining of what management regards as really important rules with respect to acquisition, asset sales, and circumstances under which the acquirer has an opportunity to set its own terms. When the bargaining unit is made up of the employees of the seller, or a majority of them, then the purchaser of assets would have to negotiate a new labor agreement if that's what it wishes to do. And in the meantime, the old terms are in effect, and that is a whole area for which there's great interest. And then finally, the board's new rules on elections, which management characterizes as ambush elections. That's a long rule that the board issued, has many, many parts, and that at some point will, I'm sure, be dissected and changed in many respects by the new majority on the board, but that too is likely to take some time. So in the meantime, there may be some legislative shortcuts to some of these issues, but that all remains to be seen too. I think I've pretty much taken up my time, and we'll be happy to answer questions that anybody might have in a little while after the others present, and I'll turn it over now to David Fortney.
Sure, John. Thank you, and greetings, everyone. What I would like to do is fill in a little bit about the issues and changes we see coming in the U.S. Department of Labor and the EEOC, two agencies that also have implemented a number of significant regulations, policies, and other changes during the Obama administration that have been quite significant and that are likely to change. I listened to the list of changes that John just cataloged for us by the NLRB, and you really realize how much has occurred, and that is certainly true similarly in the Labor Department and EEOC. Well, let's start with some of the key staffing questions, because those boxes, if you will, are beginning to get filled in. President-elect has announced that he will nominate Andrew Puzder to become serve as his Secretary of Labor. Puzder is currently the CEO of CKE Restaurants. CKE Restaurants is a parent holding company, and its principal restaurants that it operates and owns include Hardee's and Carl's Jr., both of which are well-known fast food restaurants, and CKE Restaurants employ approximately 75,000 employees. Mr. Puzder comes with a pretty strong track record of involvement and opinions with respect to a number of workplace issues, particularly those involving joint employment, particularly those involving minimum wage, as well as some immigration issues. And let me just touch on each of those because they may be instructive as he assumes his new duties, assuming that he's confirmed, which I think is highly likely. Excuse me. With respect to minimum wage, Mr. Puzder has, and I should have by way of background, Puzder also is a lawyer and practiced law and now has experience also as a senior executive within these restaurant holding companies. Husser has made his views known with respect to a number of these issues. He has a very active blog. He is a person who authors a number of opinions in Forbes magazine. The Wall Street Journal has testified before Congress multiple times on workforce issues. So he's not a stranger to these issues. With respect to minimum wage, the proposed increase of minimum wage nationwide, the federal minimum wage to $15, Mr. Poster has previously commented that he opposes that, has stated his concerns that that is too much of an increase for a national standard, recognizing that in many marketplaces that would impose a real hardship and have significant adverse consequences. However, Mr. Poster also has recognized that there are room under our system for different and higher local wages, either by state or localities, which of course is what we have today. His comments have indicated that he would favor a slower phase-in of increasing minimum wage, and has several times commented or identified that perhaps up to $9 would be an appropriate federal minimum wage. Again, these are views pretty common, held by many economists that have looked at these issues. With respect to the expansive joint employer doctrine, and John Irving in his comments identified that, and those that same view has been adopted and followed by the Labor Department agencies. Mr. Poster has recognized that the resulting consequences with respect particularly to franchise employers, and as many may know, the NLRB has major enforcement action pending against McDonald's under the joint employer doctrine. And Mr. Poster has pointed out that the expansive reading of joint employer that currently has been advocated by the administration has had very severe consequences, particularly on the franchise as well as other sectors. So he would align with changing certainly those tests too. Finally, a view that I think may surprise some, Mr. Poster's previously stated views on immigration. Mr. Poster has spoken repeatedly about the importance of lawful immigration and spoken in strong support of the H-2B programs. These are programs where immigrants come in for short periods of time and typically hold jobs in hospitality, restaurants, landscaping. These are typically lower-skilled jobs where people work for a season or shorter period of time and then leave. Some were surprised because many have understood the incoming administration as being so-called anti-immigration. Apparently, that is not Mr. Poster's view. He has spoken previously but strongly in favor of lawful immigration, and specifically the H-2B program. Other key points that I think will be very important as the Labor Department gets filled out, we're beginning to hear strong indicators as to who may hold key positions, and it appears that the common thread is that these are many people who have had prior experience and a deep understanding of the Labor Department, which would be very helpful in enabling Mr. Poster's Labor Department, the Trump administration, to hit the blocks and move out fairly quickly in implementing changes. With respect to his Deputy Secretary, Pat Pizzella, who formerly was in the Labor Department, held a senior position during the Bush administration, very well regarded, currently a member of the Federal Labor Relations Authority. The Solicitor of Labor, who is the third ranking official in the Labor Department, again, strong published reports indicating that Tammy McCutcheon, currently a partner at Littler, former Labor Department official. She formerly was the wage and hour administrator that promulgated the white-collar exemption regulations that have been the subject of a recent amendment that I'll talk about in a moment. Again, Tammy would bring an excellent understanding of the DOL agencies, operations, rulemaking, et cetera. With respect to some of the key agencies, wage and hour has proven to be perhaps one of the most critical agencies. And a gentleman by the name of Alex Passantino, who formerly served as the acting wage hour administrator, is often highlighted at this point and shortlisted as a potential nominee. All of these people would require, of course, confirmation to those positions. But if it would shape up either with those folks or ones of similar qualifications, it would present a nice combination of Mr. Puzder with his business background and understanding of these issues as a businessman and a lawyer, combined with very seasoned hands who understand the Labor Department in great detail. With respect to key issues we can anticipate the Labor Department to address pretty quickly, the overtime regulations, which recall there was a regulation that the Obama administration finalized that would have resulted in an increase in the salary test for the white-collar exemption regulations, essentially doubling that to $47,000. It would have been effective December 1. That was enjoined approximately 2 weeks ago by the judge in the Eastern District of Texas. Although there are expedited appeals pending, it is quite clear that the incoming administration, if that regulation still remains viable, I think will in due course see that it is ended. I might add a footnote, though. Assuming that that regulation as proposed by the prior administration on overtime is terminated, it is likely that there would be a new overtime regulation by the new administration, because the salary test most have agreed, which is just under $24,000, is on the low side. And if you simply would do a cost of living adjustment from when the current salary was set in 2004, we would bring it up to about $32,000 to $34,000 in that range. And I think that type of change, as well as addressing, helping to codify fluctuating work week and some other changes, may be in order. There was another controversial Labor Department regulation, so-called persuader rule, that had a very expansive reporting on advisors who advise companies in the responding to union organizing matters specifically, and the tension point there was that attorneys who provided legal advice would have been required to disclose their clients as well as the advice that was being provided, fees collected, and other information. This brought a judicial challenge from a number of states who felt that the administration improperly encroached on their ability to regulate the practice of law. The American Bar Association also opposed the rule as encroaching on the attorney privileges and related doctrine. And again, a district court in Texas has enjoined the persuader rule that was this summer. And I think it's fairly safe to say that those items will be remain on hold. There were a number of executive orders that the President Obama issued affecting federal contractors. This really represented, once the congressional avenue became blocked, the president then turned and issued executive orders that imposed additional obligations on federal contractors. Many of these were controversial and are likely to receive prompt attention. These changes, in contrast to some of the changes John was talking about for the Labor Board, an executive order, which can be issued by the president unilaterally, doesn't require congressional approval or rulemaking. Similarly, prior executive orders can be rescinded in an expedited fashion without any further involvement. Potential executive orders that are certainly under consideration, and many view as being under the chopping block, first and foremost, would be what was known as the Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces Executive Order, sometimes referred to as the blacklisting. Again, this is another major rulemaking that the courts have enjoined a portion of. Today, already, there was self-reporting on violations. There were restrictions on private arbitration agreements, except for collective bargaining, and what were called paycheck transparency obligations involving statements that needed to be included in paychecks. The first two components, self-reporting on violations and the restrictions on arbitration, those have currently been enjoined in a nationwide injunction with an expedited appeal pending. The paycheck transparency obligations are scheduled to go into place starting January 1. It is likely, I think, that the blacklisting executive order will be rescinded, which would result in all of the underlying regulations also being removed. With respect to other significant executive orders, and there were quite a few of them, there is a paid sick leave executive order that may or may not receive attention from the Obama administration. And also there was an order providing for LGBT protections that was signed. The LGBT executive order has been criticized because it does not contain a significant religious accommodation or carve-out provision. And if you look at the state of Indiana, where Governor Pence, now Vice President-elect Pence, had a similar executive order, had a quite significant carve-out for religious considerations on an LGBT-type order. That type of change is certainly possible as an amendment to the LGBT executive order. In terms of regulations, we know that all the regulations are being looked at by the agencies. They've been asked to rank their regulations from most recent to oldest and what they believe are most important. President-elect has indicated that there will be a requirement that for every new regulation issued, two regulations have to be eliminated. That is a system that has been employed successfully in England. In fact, they've moved to a 3-to-1 ratio now. We may see that happening here. Also, that there will be additional review of new regulations with a specific consideration, assessment, and evaluation on how the new regulation promotes employment opportunities that will become one of the chief requirements. Let me turn from the Labor Department, because although it is the cabinet-level advisor and has all of the various enforcement agencies, the Labor Board is independent, as John has explained, and then we also have the EEOC, which is also an independent agency. Again, like the Labor Board, the EEOC is a 5-member agency currently comprised of 2 Republicans and 3 Democrats. One of the 2 Republicans, her term has just ended. That's Constance Barker. And Congress managed to leave town without appointing her, so the president will start with a vacancy there. The president does have the right to name a new chair. It is highly likely that the remaining Republican member of the EEOC, Victoria Lipnick, will be named at least as acting chair or possibly as a permanent chair. Vicki Lipnick is, again, a very well-known, very well-regarded person. In addition to her service at the EEOC, previously served at the Labor Department, senior positions, where she and other agencies had the OFCCP and other agencies under her direction, and also very well regarded on the Hill. So it's likely that we would end up with Victoria Lipnick as the chair of the EEOC. The president also will appoint, and subject to confirmation, a new general counsel, and other key positions. So again, as with the Labor Board, filling some of these positions may take a little bit of time, may not be quite as quick as we had with the Labor Department, but we'll fill in. With respect to key initiatives that we can anticipate from the EEOC, first, out of the blocks, there is a recently enacted requirement that requires all employers with 100 or more employees to report their compensation data. Very onerous, burdensome requirement. It would first go into effect in March of 2018. There is a strong move afoot that the compensation reporting, part of EEO1 reporting, could be modified or rescinded. I think that's likely to receive favorable attention. Certainly, Victoria Lipnick has been a strong critic of that. Has advocated that there are a number of different procedures that could be followed to more effectively collect and understand employer data. There is EEOC rulemaking on the final rule on the wellness, the ability to conduct wellness exams. The EEOC I think, surprised many people, including those in the current White House, when it opined that the ability to conduct a wellness exam, say to qualify for insurance, et cetera, violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. And many people found that strange and, frankly, unacceptable. So there is a move afoot to ensure that that loose end is tied up. Finally, the EEOC has promulgated a very robust strategic plan. These are very important for guiding the agency. It is highly likely that the strategic plan just codified under the Obama administration would receive review and revisions by the Trump administration's EEOC within the first 12 months after it starts rolling. So we do see some rulemaking in EEOC, but some other changes, certainly some changes in direction, and changing. I think it's highly likely that the EEOC track record that has resulted in often what courts found to be inappropriate use of the legal enforcement authority. Current EEOC general counsel was sanctioned repeatedly, literally millions of dollars in sanctions, and has kind of an eye-popping record in that regard. I think that those more adventurous attempts to expand the law in ways that are outside the current statutes as they exist will probably be trimmed back, likely, under an EEOC headed by Commissioner Lipnick.
So, thanks, David. You've covered a lot of ground here. It was very, very useful. Let's turn it over to Brent, and let's hear his view.
I think he only needs 5 minutes of rebuttal,
yeah,
don't you, John?
Yeah. there is a lot, obviously, and I don't think that what was envisioned or would be particularly useful for me to say, oh, but I really agree with the joint employer position and here's why. You know, if that's what people want to hear on questions, I'm very happy to do it. To me, what I want to say in any event is I hope that, I mean, now we have Republican control of what will become with the appointments, all three branches. And I'm sure that folks are eager to impose their program. But I would urge folks in the administration, advising the administration, supporting the administration, whatever, to give a lot of thought to the long-term consequences for our country of what you're doing, what you're going to do. We have massive growth of inequality, in wage inequality, income inequality. We have huge swaths of the country that are economically reeling, in horrible shape. And we have to figure out what we can do to address that. And I think we are in the process of creating a much more stratified class society than we've ever had in this country before, in terms of social mobility, in terms of the wealthy having their own communities, schools, hospitals, everything in their world being really completely separate and isolated from the rest of the population. And I just think that a lot of the changes that are being proposed are going to worsen these problems. I really hope people think in terms of, I mean, one, I don't know if this analogy will be meaningful to people, but, you know, you can have a company, you can do things to boost the bottom line for a quarter or a year that end up being very injurious to the long-term health of the company. And I think that that's what I'm afraid that that's what we're going to see. Things that are attractive in terms of denying people overtime or, you know, whatever it is, not increasing the minimum wage sufficiently, whatever the issue. And that the result is the deepening of the stratification of this country, which I think very legitimately threatens our democracy and threatens our way of life in a way that, you know, we haven't seen a threat, certainly, say, since the Depression or World War II, not in certainly in my lifetime. So I'm happy to engage on any particular issue, but I really do think that when we look at what's going on, you know, we have control of the government by one party. It's a party that received the minority of votes by several million. And to take that as a mandate to, you know, I just think is going to going to cause a lot of problems. So I don't know if that's helpful to anybody or if people want me to engage on particular topics, but that's my general reaction. Obviously, these changes are going to occur. I think I don't disagree with anything John or David said. I think all those, or the great majority of those changes, will be implemented. And the question is, where is it going to take us as a country? So I'll stop there.
Okay, well, that's very helpful, and it was a good idea without, you know, having to go through each one of those issues. The point is that there are, you know, different sides to all of the things that were mentioned, and, you know, to have that discussion will be good and be interesting, and it'll be good to have people like Brent and others and David on in the discussion of all of them. Is there anything else that, David, did you have any further comment that you'd like to make?
No, John, I'd like to give the audience a shot. I'm sure they've got some questions. I think that, though, Brent's observation that, you know, short-term gain, sound public policy, he is correct. It's not about short-term. It's not based on a quarterly return. And that's why one of the reasons I am heartened by the thought that some of the key players, I think, in some of these agencies are going to be very experienced hands who do understand public policy and long-term consequences that should be effected from that. Now, reasonable minds can differ on what those policies should be, but I think that's a very important point that I fully agree with.
All right. Shall we turn this over, Tim? Tim Courtney, should we turn this over to see whether our audience or participants have any questions they'd like us to focus on?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got about almost 20 minutes left for questions. In a moment, we're all going to hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. And then after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. Again, if you'd like to jump in the queue for questions, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. While we wait for a couple questions to queue up, let me just remind everyone to check back the FedSoc website at fedsoc.org to look at the next scheduled Teleform calls. And with that, we will go to our first audience question.
Yes, John, this is Bill Emanuel. Thanks for an excellent panel discussion by all the panelists. My question relates to the ambush election rule. How do you see the board, the new board, handling that the changes in that regulation? What do you think the new board, you know, should do?
Well, this is Irving. I don't mind jumping in. And Bill, how are you? We know each other well, and
yes,
Thank you for your question. And, you know, when you think about rulemaking, you know, there are different difficulties there with respect to changes in rules and how much of it has to be done by, notice and comment and more formal rulemaking, or how much of it can be done by interpretation of rules. My guess is that a new board would be kind of looking through that rule to see, first of all, what they might disagree with, and then the best way, most efficient way, to try to get it, to try to change it. I know there are elements of it that are a real problem for a lot of people. In that new rule, there's one that I keep focusing on that has to do, I've never seen the board actually overrule a case in a rule. And it did in a case that was mostly my case called Barry National, where the board decided, contrary to the hearing officer, that I would have an opportunity at the representation case hearing to litigate the status of line leaders. And the company had all kinds of proof that and arguments that their line leaders were supervisors, and they needed to know before the election whether they're sort of eligible to be in the unit or eligible to be in management. Because if they're in management, you know, they can say certain things, and if they're in the unit, they could, if they're instructed to do certain things, it would, you know, be a potential unfair labor practice, and you need to know who's on your side and who isn't, and who can talk, and so on. And the board agreed with me in Barry National that I would be entitled, I was, you know, not enabled to or permitted to litigate that pre-election. The board agreed with me that I was. Now, they overruled that case in the rule, and I think they've got big problems going forward if somebody chooses to litigate that issue about their entitlement. Anyway, I think there'll be a lot of picking and choosing among, and the most important board rule would be that election rule, which goes on for, you know, dozens of pages.
This is Brent. If I may jump in, I think the election rule is really an important thing to look at for the following reason. All the evidence since the rule has gone into effect has been that the rule has cut down the time involved in processing the cases, has reduced the amount of expenditure of resources by the parties and the board in conducting elections, and the results have not been particularly pro-union. They have not, the number of elections has not increased dramatically. The number of elections, the win rate, the size of the units, none of it has really changed. The only thing that's really changed is there is a you know, they cut the average period of time by 10 or 12 days, the median, I guess. And so I think the evidence is that the rule has been quite successful. And I hope that this is an, sort of an example of what I was talking about. When the new board looks at the rule, they won't have a knee-jerk ideological reaction, but will in fact look at the results, which have been, you know, very, very good. And not, you know, not skewed in a pro-union way.
I think what you say is so. I know what you say is so in terms of the timing. But, you know, the timing has been collapsed substantially, with the result that employers can't really get it up front early decisions on issues that it regards as important. And I'll go back to that specialty healthcare micro unit case that I was talking about. If, you know, if the union wants to parse out a portion of what would ordinarily be the unit and file a, you know, an election petition for that, then things do really get speeded up, because it can get to its election very quickly, and if the employer disagrees and wants to get to have the board review what the regional director would do before the election, the board under that specialty health care would be, turn away probably 98% of the of those pre-election challenges, which then results in a quicker election for sure, but also means that if the employer is serious about it after the election, that's not really part of the timing equation, we'll have to litigate it and refuse to bargain and get a board decision and take it to court and so on. So when you look at sort of the back half of the election, of the rule result, it may not be as effectively time limiting as if you look at the pre-election.
I'm sorry. Are you done, John?
Yeah, you go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So just there's Brent again. Again, I think specialty health care. Take a look at the actual results. The size of the units in board elections has not changed. The median number of employees in the unit has not changed following specialty health care. There's no evidence that specialty health care has produced a change in the size of the unit. Not only that, every court of appeals that has looked at it, and there are four or five of them, I believe, has endorsed specialty health care and said it's not a change in policy. Specialty health care has always been the law. When John says, well, you're carving out a portion of what's normally the unit, that's not accurate. The unit is any, under the labor board, any appropriate unit that the union petitions for. If it's an appropriate unit, that's the unit in which you go to election. It is only if you can show, and this has always been true, that the petition for unit is inappropriate, that you can expand it. Now, I'm sure the new board will find it, different, we'll look at it differently and find only a bigger unit is appropriate much more often than the current board. But again, there's to me a sort of ideological reaction that if you look at the facts and the evidence, there's just not that much to complain about or anything to complain about.
I think I'm kind of guided by, maybe overly guided by, my own experience with that, and that was a case where the union petitioned for production employees and specifically wanted excluded the maintenance employees who worked with production employees. And normally, in a presumptively appropriate unit, we've production and maintenance, so they just wanted the production employees, and it was a practical matter. They were, I think, concerned that the mechanical maintenance employees were not as pro-union. So they get an election in just that portion of the production unit without the people that, and it's difficult to make the argument that there's such an over, and there was a clear interaction, but was that like overwhelming situation where, it's so crystal clear that the maintenance people should be. Then you have to litigate that and you go on and on. But, yeah, I mean, the size of the maintenance unit stayed, but it didn't include, or size of the production unit stayed as before, but it didn't include a substantial number of maintenance people.
I think I'm going to break in here really quick. I just want to make sure we have time to get to our next question. Again, just a reminder to request the floor. Enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. And with that, we're going to go to our next question.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is a bit more on the arbitration side of things from the first lecture. Last year, DirecTV's case in the Supreme Court, was ruled in their favor that they could require their customers to participate in mandatory arbitration. Is it possible, do you think, that the Supreme Court could use that case as justification for companies to make the same mandate for their employees? or do you think the National Labor Relations Act provides some kind of textual roadblock for that?
You're asking everybody or anybody in particular?
Oh, just anybody in particular.
let Irving start on that.
Okay.
I would just say that that it is that issue or that type of issue that is presently before the Supreme Court right now in that case that the ARP used to petition for cert to resolve the differences among the between the among the courts. It's called Murphy Oil. And the Supreme Court's being asked to resolve this difference. I mean, the NLRB, the NLRA says that private dispute resolution should be preferred, and there's a strong national policy in favor of arbitration. And yet the NLRB takes the position that somehow the Section 7 concerns of employees takes precedent, and about half the courts have said the NLRB is right, and half the courts have said it's wrong. So it's something that the Supreme Court is going to have to resolve.
Well,
now, do you have any predictions how they'll resolve it?
I think it probably depends upon the balance in the Supreme Court, to be honest with you.
If I may just jump in, just to be clear about what the issue is, the Labor Board is not preventing arbitration or even mandatory arbitration. The only thing the Labor Board has said is illegal is where you have mandatory arbitration and you have banned class or collective or two or more employees joining together around the same issue. And that's, in their opinion, which I agree with, based squarely on the text of Section 7 of the NLRA, which gives workers the right to come together to try to better their wages and conditions of work, including, and the law is very clear, that Section 7 includes grievances or issues that would go to arbitration, such as enforcing the FLSA. So that is the heart of the argument. What the court will do with it, we'll see. But that's why it's not settled by the consumer arbitration issues. And let me just say, to me, this issue really, look, if employers can require individual arbitration of fair, minimum wage and overtime claims, as well as others. The reality is, and I hope people understand this, it has been essentially the repeal of the FLSA, because nobody will be able to enforce the FLSA in any meaningful way if you have to do individual arbitration. And I don't care if the minimum wage is $9 or $35, it's going to be irrelevant because it will never be meaningfully enforced. And people who are hot on this issue on the management side, I hope you seriously consider whether that's good for our society that the courts have repealed the FLSA in reality. I mean, that would be the effect. If I may have one more moment, we have under Obama since the Great Recession, there have been something, whatever it is, 8 million jobs added. I don't know the number. Lots of jobs added, unemployment down. And the problem is, or a huge problem is, that the jobs are low wage, part-time, contingent, that don't provide a meaningful path into the middle class. And things like judicial repeal of the FLSA may give us more jobs, but they will give us if they do, which, you know, is questionable in my mind, but assuming for a moment they do, they will further the class stratification of this country, cement a permanent underclass, and be a huge threat to our democracy. But other than that, I'm neutral on the subject.
Well, I would just, and maybe it's kind of a concluding remark, as we go through these changes in personnel, particularly the board, because one of the most, and the for the last 6 or 8 years, the role that the minority on the board has played with very good, very significant legal arguments in dissent and so forth, guiding the courts. I hope that when the balance changes on the board, that there will be dissenters, Democrat board members of the same kind of quality as the current dissenters, and people like Brent Garren, for instance, who are persuasive and know the law, and you know, that attitude and that point of view, as in the past 8 years, needs to be expressed and expressed well by dissenters on the board.
Agreed.
Since we're right up against our time limit here, if we could get some quick final thoughts from Brent or David, if you have any.
I kind of gave my final thought.
Okay. This is David. I think some people, I'm a little concerned, have had the view that there will either be no regulations, no enforcement, that this will be sort of a wide open environment we're moving into. And everything that I'm seeing and hearing is that is not going to be the case. There are going to be some philosophical differences in approach, yes, but the enforcement agencies are going to continue to enforce. Compliance is going to continue to be a critical part. And I think that there will be even expansion into areas, including paid leave, compensation enforcement, and a variety of issues where the horizons will continue to change for all of us. So it will be different, but it's not ending.
Thank you very much. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd again like to thank David Fortney, Brent Garren, and John Irving for joining us today. And to all of our listeners and those who ask questions, please keep checking back the our website at fedsoc.org for teleforms in the future. Thanks so much for joining us, and with that, we are adjourned.